Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller. Today we'll hear how a poet, Catherine McNamara, views some of the problems writers, translators, and collectors have in bringing traditional Native literature into the English language in a way that preserves the essential elements of the original. The term being used lately in this field is ethnopoetics. It takes something from anthropology and something from the poets.
Two very important poets have had an enormous effect on modern North American poetry. Those are Ezra Pound and Charles Olson. Both of them stressed not so much writing for the page as listening to the speech around us, recovering some of that flavor. Ezra Pound talked about the melody of the line rather than formal meter and so on. Charles Olson talked about the importance of conveying the energy from the word across to the reader.
Yeah, that's what seems to be lacking so often.
Well, one of the things that that we hear differently than we hear differently in town, let's say, than we do in the village, is silence. There's a relationship between silence and talking that one becomes far more aware of in the village. The silence takes on, in poetic terms, something like the function of white space around the words and between the lines. An interesting thing happened, and you can locate it in some people. In the last 10 or 15 years, a group of anthropologists and linguists have been paying great attention to performance, what I was talking about before, how and when the story happens, and among what group. They've been wrestling with, and they had the advantage of audio tapes, they wrestled with how to put that on the page in some way that conveyed the flavor of the performance. Well, you have to take account of silence and a pitch and tone of audience response and so on. And how do you do that? Well, it didn't seem like there was very much, I guess, to them in our paragraph form, in the way that we write essays and also novels, that conveyed that flavor. You know, wrestling dialogue and monologue onto the page is a considerable problem for a writer, and anyone who can do it well is someone to be respected. There's one fellow in particular. Well, Del Himes, an anthropologist, really started paying some attention to this with Northwest Coast texts. Well, it's an interesting thing about Del Himes. He was a roommate in college, I think at Reed, but maybe at Indiana, I've forgotten exactly, of Gary Snyder, who's a very prominent Western American poet, one of the, to my mind, one of the major poets of, you know, the post-war period, somebody I myself have learned a great deal from, I think. Gary Snyder went off to college thinking he wanted to be an anthropologist. Del Himes went off to college thinking he wanted to be a poet, and those two were roommates. And you can be pretty sure, that they read some of the same things, including Pound and Olson, and including people like Franz Boas and Edward Sapir and so on. And you get this intermixture happening. Well, Snyder goes on to be a great poet, still interested in anthropology. Del Himes goes on to be an anthropologist, interested in the speaking out, okay? So that crossover has been very fertile and has made it possible for the stories of those places to come out into our world in a way that recognizes their integrity. Dennis Tedlock, who's a linguist, spent a lot of time with Zunis, Zuni people in the Southwest. And he said he had all these tapes that he was trying to get onto the page, and nothing was working very well. Then he said, I guess it was in the early 70s, he went to a modern poetry reading. And he suddenly realized he had a way of putting this stuff on the page, and that was to pay attention to lines and stanzas and verses and so on. And so now when you read this stuff on the page, you have a way of reading it in a way that tells you when to pause, when to raise or lower your voice. And you, reading through it yourself, you get some sense of what it's like to speak it out. And then, well, the next, and that's in almost in a way structural and mechanical. The next big step is to try to learn something about, you know, where these, the place that these stories are coming from, out of whose mouths they're coming and so on.
And maybe a sound or the melody of that particular language. In the villages, there are what some people say are two kinds of English. And
oh, well, I lived in a village where I heard at least four different kinds. You could tell people's accents, you know. Some people came from a village up north, and some came from one over the mountain, and they spoke at different tempos and so on. I guess it's hard to talk about this exactly. I'm not sure I have the right words for it, but I'll tell you about what I think I was hearing. I think my own language, I was raised in the East, where it's a high value to be complicated in your sentence structures, to use a lot of words, to use them adroitly, and so on. So verbosity is a high value there. Silence is very striking and rare when people speak. When I went to interior Alaska, I heard something very different, and I had lived before in Europe, so I knew a little bit about how to keep my mouth shut. What I heard, well, where I live now, I should be real specific about this. Where I live, it seems like most of the kids grow up speaking English as their first language. Well, what do we mean by English? That's a really good question. English is so vast and has so many sources and so on, and there are so many ways of speaking it. And as you travel across North America, you hear a lot of those different ways, okay? The question of so-called village English, I'm uneasy with that name, but I don't know what else to say. How people speak in their own villages to each other, as one lady said to me, how our native people speak, how we tell each other, seems to me to have become very specific to that place. And to me, this is quite a fascinating thing and not unusual. One thing I think we always have to remember is that once the United States took over Russia, there was a systematic attempt from the very beginning to eradicate local languages and to make people speak North American English of some variety or other. Our North American English wasn't standardized till rather late, and even now I haven't met very many teachers who speak what I consider a standard English, so that one's a hard one to talk about too.
But we know the difference about what we speak in school. We know school English from street English.
Right.
No matter how you talk, you know school teacher talk from...
That's right.
From street talk.
But people's language is taken away from them. There are people around whose mouths were taped when they were children, or who were locked in closets, or who were sent out into the cold, punishing them for speaking their language. It stayed with them. Well, so... But people learn to speak English in many ways. And I think something very radical happened. I think that even though the language was imposed, although it was also good for trade and contact and so on, so people, there were reasons to learn English. I think what I've seen and where I've lived is that people speak a variety of it that's appropriate to that place. That the English people speak to each other is one of the languages now of that place. And it isn't, a lot of times people from outside go into villages and they think, well, if we just speak simple sentences, people will understand what we're saying. That's not true at all. You're still speaking the wrong language because you don't know the local language. You don't know what verbs people use or what a noun. People where I lived below a large lake, and they'd say, up the lake. You know, well, it took a little while to know what all of that meant. people's relatives had places up there, or, you know, you remembered boating trips on Sunday afternoon, or you know what it was like to watch the salmon run up. Whole layers and layers and layers of associations with that, of that phrase, up the lake. And you started to realize you didn't use that very lightly. And it was a great pleasure to be able to say that and know that you knew something of what people meant when they said up the lake, and that when you said that, people knew that you knew something mm-hmm. about it. So a radical adaptation. And it's not in any way, as some teachers seem to think, or some school people or missionaries or outsiders thought, substandard English. No, it's not that at all.
In fact, it's creative English or inventive, or is it more a case of English through the thought in another language?
Well, that happens. I mean, you see kids writing in English, only the stories are Athabaskan. So it's not a matter of exactly what words you use. Exactly. It's a complicated problem. Basically, I guess what I think is, if you're going to try to find anything about it, it's up to you to learn the local language.
Because in case of villages, it could be the native language, the third language, which is an English adaptation, and then the other would be your school.
Something
English.
Like that.
You're in the village and you're teaching poetry, you're talking about poetry. Do you find surprising, or just what kind of images come out of that way that people speak?
Oh, well, I was in a village a year ago at Christmas, and I stayed there for about 3 days. The teacher over there is a pretty remarkable woman, and the high school teacher, and the kids were really great, and I got to spend 3 days with them. And I think maybe the second day there was this high school girl who was a very, very interesting girl. I don't know if I should use names or not, so I won't. But I'd like to. I just, you know, don't want to do it without permission. But anyway, about the second day, this girl came to me with a paper, and she said to me, "Do you think this is anything?" And I looked at it, and this is what I read. Snow. As I sit here looking out the window in this warm house, I see things I have seen every day of my life. I see snow, beautiful white sparkling snow. It covers the ground like a blanket of diamonds. I see snow, beautiful white sparkling snow. It rests on the trunks of trees like a blanket of diamonds. I see snow, beautiful white sparkling snow. It covers the roofs of houses like a blanket of diamonds. I see snow covering the earth like a blanket of diamonds. I have seen this every day of my life. Beautiful snow, beautiful white sparkling snow, covering this earth like a blanket of diamonds. Beautiful snow forever. And I looked at her and I said, "That's a poem." And she said, "That's a poem? I never wrote one before."
She probably did every day of her life.
Well, yes.
You've been listening to Chinook with poet Catherine McNamara. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, Portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. Not long ago, Fairbanks was host to an economic development conference which focused on what was being called the Energy Corridor. That's the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Alaska Highway Gas Line, which is planned to branch off the oil pipeline and wend its way into Canada to the lower 48. Representing Canada at the conference was Member of Parliament Bernard Loisel of Quebec. He is the Parliamentary Secretary to the head of Canada's Department of Native Affairs and Northern Development. That corresponds somewhat to our Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I asked him about native land claims in Canada and found out that instead of a unified claim, four groups of Canadian natives are negotiating separate claims in the Yukon, Northwest Territories, and in the Eastern Arctic, and that the claims are being pressed primarily by Inuit and Athabascans. Another difference from Alaska is that the Canadian government has appropriated funds to help the native groups pay for the negotiations in Ottawa, so that the natives don't have to bear the whole expense. The process is underway, and Secretary Loisel is optimistic, but according to some news clippings I found, the various native groups are not quite so confident.
Look, it's under negotiations. What we can do more than to sit at the table. We decide to do it with full-time negotiator. Then I think that you have to make a line to put a line between the cultural problem and the claims itself, because in Canada I think that maybe we did a lot of things wrong, but on the cultural side I think that we have a good record on this to respect the different culture that of our population. We are not a melting pot. We don't want to be a melting pot. And, a Canadian Italian is a Canadian Italian, and a native, and our native people must keep, and not just keep, but promote their own culture, and we want it. For what I would call the economic side of the question, I think that we recognize the principle that they must have a share within the constitutional development of our country. The native people will be involved. And if you talk about bread and butter for tomorrow, we want to be sure that we can have some equity or at least a word to say in the different projects which are going on.
Is then some of the demand that's... Well, you have to tell me what some of the... what each region or group or agency, native voice, is asking for in land claims. Is it like in Alaska, land and money, or is it maybe involved in royalties development?
Yes, they are asking for lands, for money, for royalty, but there is something more. They and we agree with this. They are asking to have the opportunity to say how they want this development. And I think that is quite normal because it's their area, it's their, and they want to be full participant. Because of their special culture, they want to probably, they want to manage the services to themselves differently than we do for us. And we try via our department to promote such possibility and... I think it's not going so badly.
I don't know how familiar you are with the history of Alaska native land claims.
I'm not really familiar. I heard about this. I don't have any comments about what is going on here. It's not my business.
I'm wondering if you're taking any lessons or learning from the Alaskan experience, and if there's been any effort on your department's part to find out the effects of, for instance, the Hall Road, the pipeline, and the whole intertwining between land claims, demands, and the pipeline coming into.
Yes, we did. We took lessons from here and from some other place. And also, I would say that our people, our native people in Canada, took lessons from what is going on here. And maybe it will be easier for us. And when I say us, I say the native and the government to conclude something maybe better because we have this experience. I think that there is a move to West, but not the same way that it happened in the United States. And you had your approach, we have ours, and but we will have in the future to work together because you know Alaska is a privileged neighbor because you know your future and ours is so similar. Then we are in the same type of evolution, you know, and with the gas and oil industry, with the mining industry. We are the people responsible to develop the North. And I hope that, as I mentioned earlier, that in 20, 25 years from now, we will be able to say we did it properly.
Mm-hmm. There is there are people that say that the Alaska land claims would not have been settled at the way as rapidly as it was with the results that it did if there had not been pressure on the federal government to settle it in order to get development, in order to get that pipeline built. Is there a similar pressure from the native groups to say that we're going to hold this up, we're going to put these claims on, we're going to fight it in court, saying if you want your pipeline, you better solve the problem?
Yeah, I think that for sure the development, you know, the necessity of the development is pressure on both sides. For the native, because they have to get an agreement right now, otherwise it will be too late. And for us, we have to find the right solution. That's why we attempt to involve the private sector in the process. And we said to the mining and to the gas and oil industry that they must be involved and they must share and realize the same principle that the government did. At the same time, you know, we are all the time saying that private sector is there just to make money and they don't care about the rest, you know, environment. And so I must say that the new generation of manager that I see, my impression is that they are really more concerned about all these things. And, you know, this type of whole, I don't want to put any name, but this type of whole president of company, you know, saying, gee, I'm there just for my money and I'll kill you if you, you know. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that it disappears, and it's encouragement for me to see that, you know, this new type, new generation of manager with all these concerns, you know, they are also president of a company, but they are also citizen, and they realize every day in their decision that they have also a responsibility as citizen. And I don't know if you see it in Alaska, but in Canada, I think that, you know, everything is not honey, but it's a good sign on for the near future, I think. And that's why they want to be involved, and that's why the private sector is consulted in the negotiations, and because you know it's a claim from the native people, but it's also a project for everybody.
Mm-hmm. If I were a native from the Yukon or from our fairly neighboring village of Old Crow up in the interior, I can't ask the question that they might be just dying to ask you, but perhaps from somebody that is a native wanting some control, worried about hunting, worried about subsistence, worried about what that dumpster highway has already done, for instance. Mm. What kinds of can you just be your own devil's advocate for a minute and say what some of the problems are?
Look, we have to put a question. Do we stop? We have to put a question that way. I think do we stop any development? Because if we want to keep it exactly as it was before, you don't build any road. You don't build any pipeline. You push away the mining industry and the gas and oil industry, okay? You say, no, we want to keep the caribou and we want to keep as it was, okay? Mm-hmm. It's an approach, but it's not the one accepted by the majority of Canadian and probably of the American, because when we talk about national interest within those, you know, under this principle of the national interest, Native people are too, and they are Canadian too. Then the question that we must have, and the approach that we must take, is how can we go on with these projects necessary for Canada, and at the same time to respect and find some ways to permit to the Native people to continue to live in a way acceptable for them. Okay? It's true that with a highway, you know, your caribou, there is a problem. But do we put the highway or do we keep the caribou as it was? You know, I think everybody must have the question, the Native too. And when you talk about to the Native people in Canada, they realize that if it's not this year, it will be probably in 10 years from now. If we have an energy crisis and we are running out of oil or gas, they will accept you think to say, no, we want to keep our caribou, and we don't care if you are freezing in your home during the winter. I think that themselves, they would refuse to take such approach. Then we have to find a way where, you know, we have to find a balanced decision.
Mm-hmm. But it seems to me then you're saying that it is a foregone conclusion that there will be pipelines, there will be highways.
No. Look, we want to change at the minimum the type of life, but at the same time, or to realize the development with the less change possible. Then we have to use our imagination and all what we have good in us,
and try to be
sure that we won't have this kind of wild development that we have known in the past. Mm-hmm. It's true that there. I know. I have an example in my mind where we had mine and we didn't care at all that people living in the in a reserve at, you know, within a mile from there. We didn't care of them. We say no. It won't happen now in Canada. We refuse this type mm-hmm. of wild development.
And you, what I'm reading into some of what you're saying is that new caring and that concern is somehow inherent in the new generation of politicians, perhaps a new generation of managers, and it's built into the consciousness. It's not something that's being imposed, mm-hmm. and yeah. you have great faith in that.
Yeah. Yes, because I believe that anyway, for everything, okay, the best element that we can have are people. You just can't, by law, impose the good, the human being. You just can't. It's language, culture, religion, and human being. Okay, maybe you feel good to have a jeans, and maybe I feel good to wear a tie, but I just can't pass a law and say you will feel good with the tie and I'll feel good with a jean.
Or that you will feel good with a highway and frozen vegetables from the grocery store, or you will feel good with a muktuk and mukluks.
That's it.
Canada's Parliamentary Secretary of Native Affairs and Northern Development, Bernard Loisel. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.